listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. My name is Ethan Clow, your host here on The Sector, and as always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course, streaming live at CITR.ca, and via podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. If you're listening live on Friday, April 10th, good morning to you. And of course, if you're listening at a different time, well, welcome to the show regardless. We have a great show today here on episode 41 of The Sector. Lots to discuss. We have a few updates from last week. I wanted to actually play a few more clips from relevant topics that we discussed last week. Of course, we mentioned the sort of Twitter fiasco that resolved around Trevor Noah, the replacement for The Daily Show. And I wanted to play a short clip. Actually, Jon Stewart addressed it and, you know, take a listen to that and see what he had to say. Maybe we'll agree, maybe we won't. But I think it's, you know, good food for thought and kind of segues nicely into today's show. I also want to talk a bit about the question of privacy here in Canada and around the world. Last week, I mentioned a bit about the Conservative government's what's been sort of termed the anti-privacy bill and the effect that can have, and also ways that people are kind of rejecting that bill. The ways that some people, not all, but some, have kind of rallied around this notion that, you know, this is going too far and we need to roll back and reevaluate what is important for Canadians in terms of privacy. So that's going to be an interesting topic to discuss. We have a bit of news on the nonprofit sector, specifically charities who are standing up and saying we are not going to tolerate these politically motivated audits anymore. There is a new letter which has been signed by a number of prominent leaders in the charity community, which we'll evaluate and take a look at later on. There's also been a bit of breaking news here locally in Vancouver. An oil spill, which occurred on Thursday, which has made the rounds news-wise. Again, not necessarily hugely related to a nonprofit or social justice component of the show, but I think we've actually touched base on kind of environmental issues here in the past. And this is an interesting way to kind of revisit that conversation. So we have a jam-packed show, lots to discuss, should be very interesting, and you can take my word for it because I wouldn't lie to you. Anyway, before we move on to taking a quick break, though, however, we have some pretty awesome housekeeping news to announce. So you may remember that a few weeks ago, CITR had its annual fund drive. This is to raise money for station operations, staffing, technology, all that great stuff. All that money that we raise is going to go to building a new website, a dynamic website which will allow linking of podcasting and articles and music, creating a very easily searchable, easily navigatable website designed for our listeners to basically have at their fingertips some of the great content that has been created over the many years of CITR's operation. Now, as always, we asked our listeners to call in to donate or to go to CITR.ca and donate. I wanted to take a minute just right now to thank some of the donors who donated and specifically mentioned The Sector as the reason for their donation. So a big thank you to Robin, Marlene, and Siobhan for contributing. We raised a lot of money, and it was fantastic to have our listeners support us. It's very heartening to know that people enjoy what I'm doing, and hopefully you all are learning things, and I'm learning things right now, so, you know, it's hopefully we're both kind of, you know, learning and growing and all that wonderful stuff. Also, I want to give a big congratulations to our program coordinator, Robin, and his wife, Danielle, on their new baby girl. So congratulations, guys. I hope that parenthood is as exciting as you hoped it would be, and that somehow you managed to get just enough sleep to get you through the days. We look forward to having Robin back at the station and seeing some very cute baby pictures very soon. Once again, congratulations to you guys on expanding your family. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in 5 words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, your host. So last week on the show, we dived into the messy world of Twitter, talking about Trevor Noah, who, if you don't know, is going to be the next host of The Daily Show, a extremely popular comedy show, but has, I think, morphed into sort of this comedy slash news slash current events show that is beloved by, you know, young progressives all over the world. So, okay, Trevor Noah, great. But then people start digging through Noah's old Twitter accounts and they find some of these jokes that are actually kind of offensive. They go beyond being mere offensive at times to kind of, well, a little bit racist, a little bit bigoted. And this, I think, justly, actually made people a little bit nervous. They started to ask themselves, just who is this Trevor Noah, and why is he taking over our beloved Daily Show, exactly? So, you know, this spurred on some criticism, which spurred on meta-criticism of the criticism, resulting in a series of blog posts and Twitter rants and examinations of critical media and what it means and blah, blah, blah. And well, it was, yeah, okay, whatever. But I think what a lot of us were waiting for and wanted to hear was a bit of an explanation, a bit of a careful analysis from the current host of The Daily Show, Jon Stewart, the man who steers that ship, the sort of captain, if you will. And no doubt he was a big player and deciding, you know, who was going to replace him. This was the house that Stewart built. And, you know, you would think that he would have an opinion, a viewpoint, a set of requirements, perhaps, a way to vet whoever would be replacing him. You'd think that he wouldn't just sit back and let anyone walk in. So anyway, a few days ago, The Daily Show aired a brief segment where Jon Stewart really quickly addressed the issue of Trevor Noah and his Twitter account. So I want to actually play that clip for you. It's only a few minutes long. And then let's have a listen to that, and we'll come back and talk about it after.
And obviously we're going to talk about the elephant in the room, the big news that I'm sure you all heard from last week. Seth Rollins won the WWE World Championship. My nemesis! Respect, though, to Seth. That was a shrewd movie pulled, and I appreciate that. Also, they have hired a new Daily Show host. Mr. Trevor Noah is going to be hosting the show. And I'm very excited about it. And I will say, I know there was a large kerfuffle on Twitter. But I can say this, I think, without hesitation. Trevor Noah will earn your trust and respect. Or not. Just as I earned your trust and respect. Or did not. Or sometimes earned it and then lost it and then kind of got it back, but then it was like, that guy, and then it was, oh, that rally was so stupid, I'm never, no, oh, I hate him! Like, it kind of just goes that way. The only thing I would say is, I do hope you give him an opportunity to earn that trust and respect, because my experience with him is that he is an incredibly thoughtful and considerate and funny and smart individual. And man, I think you give him that time and it's going to be well worth it. I'm excited for where he's going to take this thing. I'm going to watch. I'm going to set my DVR to finally, after 17 years, I'm going to record The Daily Show.
And we're back here on The Sector. So that was Jon Stewart's defense of Trevor Noah, the new host of The Daily Show, as soon as, you know, Jon Stewart leaves, of course. I don't know. What do you think about that? Did that assuage any of you out there? Were, if you had concerns about Noah, did that help them go away, or were you a bit disappointed? You know, I sort of thinking back on it and listening to what, you know, Stewart said, it's kind of interesting in a couple of respects. One, you know, he's known for being very funny, obviously. He's a comedian. But Stewart has an ability to make things serious, to really kind of demonstrate his very high intelligence and kind of, in a way that's almost a bit disarming, but, you know, segue from comedy into serious conversation. Now, I kind of wonder, because I don't really think he did that so much for that clip. At least not in the sense that, you know, we've seen him do so before. Like, we've seen Jon Stewart, you know, eviscerate people on his show, right to their face sometimes. So that's, I think, you know, what some people were kind of hoping he would do, maybe. You know, and I think that was actually pretty unlikely. I think it was very, very unlikely that he would do so to the incoming. I think that would just make the story so much bigger and so much more, you know, it would change the dynamic of the story, much to Noah's discredit in that case. But what's interesting is that, you know, he did sort of try to minimize and I think push away sort of the idea that this is a true demonstration of Noah's personality. Now, that and actually could totally be true. The idea that somebody would be the same comedian they were, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, they are today is obviously going to be, you know, a true fact. The fact that somebody will evolve and change as their comedy goes. What's also somewhat interesting, though, is that Noah himself wasn't present on the show. He didn't come up to defend himself. That was left strictly to Jon Stewart. And you do kind of wonder, you know, maybe had he brought Noah out there and asked him to explain in his own words, would that have been a bit more satisfactory? You know, again, it's hard to say, right? But it does, I think, raise a few questions about the idea of the changing face of comedy. There was a time when comedians basically had the control of the conversation. They went out, they did their thing, and you might get a newspaper article here or there about them, but there was never that kind of instant feedback that you get with something like Twitter or social media. So that's changed the dynamic. And doing comedy in this new day and age, well, it's not the same as, you know, when you did it with, in the old days, you know, George Carlin and others who went up there and said whatever they felt like it. They now have to deal with this idea of, well, people are going to hold you to what you say. And again, as I mentioned, I think last week, isn't that a good thing? I mean, don't we want comedy or even any entertainment, really? Don't we want to have that kind of reality where we are aware and conscious of what we say, respecting the fact that if we go out there and we say outrageous things, people are going to, you know, think outrageous thoughts about us. So I don't know. We'll have to see how this plays out. Again, it could be much ado about nothing, but I do think it is a worthwhile conversation to have simply because of the way that social media is changing how we have conversations about things. Now, to maybe segue into a different topic, I was recently perusing the social medias, examining the various trendingness of certain topics, and something came up that was a little bit interesting. Floating around on some of the skeptic atheist humanist blogs was a question about discussing social justice issues, for lack of a better term, and the nature of how that conversation tends to evolve. Now, what I found interesting was there was a bit of a kerfuffle over the idea of trying to, I guess you could use the term, quantify the social justice issues. Now, I'm sure that we've all heard at some point in time a kind of dismissive attitude about an issue by saying, well, people are getting worked up over X problem. Meanwhile, there are people who are being X'd to the second level somewhere else in the world. And I think the specific topic in this case was the recent anti-gay law in Indiana. And somebody had made the comment about, well, people in America are more concerned that a gay person can't order a pizza than they are about female genital mutilation in Middle Eastern countries, or something along those lines. Or people are more concerned about gay people not being able to have a cake at their wedding than they are about ISIS, or, again, some far more, I think, dramatic social justice issue relating to war and conflict, usually in the Middle East or Africa or something. Now, this process of trying to minimize one social justice injustice by comparing it to seemingly a greater injustice is fairly common when you come into these kind of debates on where should we be directing our energy, where should we be directing our focus. Indeed, this conversation comes up just as much in the nonprofit charity world. We would often think that the primary focus of a nonprofit for charity should be, you know, alleviating suffering. But there are charities and nonprofits out there that focus on more mundane things. Not necessarily things that are completely unimportant, but just things that don't quite have the same gravitas as curing cancer or fighting AIDS or whatever it is that they're focused on. You know, you could have a charity that focuses on buying musical instruments for disadvantaged children. That's a cause that exists. This, of course, raises perhaps an uncomfortable question. Are there more important causes, period? Do we have a system in place where we are sometimes valuing lives and the quality of life compared to things that really aren't all that important in the grand scheme of things? Things like, you know, supporting a local community radio station versus supporting an overseas charity that feeds hungry people. What's interesting about this, and I think what people sometimes miss, is that charity is not necessarily a closed system, meaning donating to one charity does not necessarily mean or have to mean that another charity is losing funds. This is, I think, one of the important aspects of things like fundraisers, why they need to be out there and explaining their cause and explaining why their charity has an impact. Because if you don't do that, if you don't have people out there who can explain what you're doing and why it's important, you can really start to think that if I donate to, you know, this charity, that means I'm taking potential money away from a different charity. But that's not really the case, because by donating to one charity, I may be alleviating part of the problem for a different charity, right? Because think about it. If your charity is dealing with, let's say, for instance, poverty, hunger on the streets of Vancouver, and I donate to a charity that focuses on crime reduction. Now, you could say, oh, well, you've cost the poverty charity money. Well, maybe not. Maybe this other charity, in some different roundabout way, is addressing a problem that is systemic across the board. Meaning, this charity is taking on an issue that in some way will make the poverty less severe in Vancouver. So we don't have to look at charity and the nonprofit sector as these closed systems that are competing with each other. Rather, we can look at them as a linked system, that sometimes dollars donated to one area affects another area. Let's go back to the question of issues. So when someone says that we are focusing too much on one particular social justice issue that is irrelevant compared to a more severe issue somewhere else in the world, what should be the response to that? You know, what first of all, is that even true? Are we somehow neglecting or ignoring a more pressing and important issue in lieu of something that is frivolous or, in the grand scheme of things, not that important? Well, I think what's interesting about this is that it's something of a bit of a paradox. There's always going to be a more pressing issue. I mean, no matter what you think of, there's always going to be something that's just a bit more important. You know, you could look at the environment as a great example of this. Let's talk about saving an endangered species. Okay, great. So we're saving, you know, the black bear. They're beautiful, they're important to the environment, et cetera, et cetera. But what about the whole issue of climate change? That's probably more important than saving one species. What about deforestation? That's talking about saving an entire ecosystem of animals that live in the forest. What about talking about the oil industry, which chops down forests, pollutes the environment, causes global warming, and wipes out endangered species? You see, in just a span of a couple seconds, we've gone from saving one species, a focused campaign on saving the black bear, to talking about a vast, almost impossible process of taking out the oil industry. There's always going to be a bigger fish to fry. Does that mean that starting with a minnow is a waste of time and resources? I won't say that, you know, never say never, because I'm sure that on certain circumstances, you could make an argument that yes, it is, you know, much ado about nothing, or that you are wasting resources by focusing on a small little problem. But again, problems are problems because they need to be addressed. Ignoring one because there's a bigger problem somewhere else is not really helping. If you have problem A, and it's smaller in some scale than problem B, by fixing problem B, you still haven't solved problem A. That's the problem. I'm saying problem too many times. The problem is, oh God, I have to stop. Look, okay, here's the thing. If we are going to look at an issue like gay marriage in America, and you have a place that refuses to serve gay people, whether they're trying to order a pizza, whether they're trying to order a wedding cake, whatever, they're not serving people. So this would fall under bigotry, discrimination. Even you could even make the case that it's part of racism there. There are elements of dehumanization going on. Lots of problems with that issue. Now, if you're going to compare it to something like ISIS, well, again, there are a whole slew of related issues to ISIS that exist and that are problems and that must be solved. But if we divert our attention away from the local issue of discrimination and bigotry and focus it on ISIS, that's great, but is that energy going to make a difference? Are we actually going to solve ISIS? I would argue that probably not. And in fact, by refocusing our energy, or at least making it seem like we need to refocus our energy, talking down to fellow activists, trying to make it seem like we're making a mountain out of a molehill, you know, that whole shebang, I think, actually doesn't do any good. I think it actually causes a lot of harm. The main thing is that you leave the gay marriage issue unaddressed because somebody told us this is a waste of time. It's not as important as something else. So, okay, we drop that issue. It goes unresolved. We refocus our energy on a different issue. One that we are convinced is the top of the mountain, top of the heap, the big problem, the big deal that we have to focus on. How? You now have a bunch of activists who probably don't have a lot of experience addressing this issue now focused on it. Okay, but how do you develop their energy? How do you segue them in a way that makes a tangible impact on this other really big, severe issue? This is the problem. This is why I've always maintained, even when I was on Radio Free Thinker and talking with Dawn about science and skepticism, that criticizing somebody else's activism usually never works. The main thing is that they may be focused on an issue that you think is frivolous. Maybe they're focused on something that you don't think is relevant or all that important, but that's where their expertise lie. That's where they're going to have the most impact. Criticizing their efforts, making them feel unappreciated, creating an antagonistic relationship with them, all of those things are negative outcomes. They don't help you, they don't help them, and if anything, they create greater friction when it comes time to collaborate down the road. Never mind that for a moment, though. It also doesn't help because having them redirect their efforts to whatever it is you think is important probably won't help you because they don't have the same skill set, background, or experience to deal with a problem that you think is important. This is really vital, and I think people misunderstand this so much in the world of the nonprofit charity sector. Having experience and understanding how to direct your efforts is really almost half the battle in a lot of cases. It's one thing to get together with your friends and your allies and to go protest a bill. That's, you know, citizen democracy in action, and that's great. But there's a tangible difference between, you know, organizing a protest about something and then organizing an effort to change that thing. One thing has to operate within a legal framework, a world of legislation and lobbying and, you know, compromise and meetings and, you know, going through a process. The other is about getting together, getting organized, and making your voice heard. One of them is a lot easier. You know, it may not seem easy, but let's face it, it is easier to organize a protest than it is to organize the long process of changing a law or changing a bill or, you know, going to the Supreme Court for some reason. So again, we come back to this notion of when it comes time to criticize other activists or other projects, make sure that what you're doing is productive. If you're doing something that is either going to frustrate or alienate or annoy, ask yourself, is all that, you know, negative buildup, is that going to help anything? Am I going to honestly convince anybody to stop focusing on their project and redirect their energy and time to something that I think is important? Because if the answer is no, then why are you doing it? Why are you just raising somebody's, you know, ire by saying, oh, you stupid fool, why are you so concerned about someone having cake than you are about human rights violations in Egypt? And of course, this is not to say that there are not huge important issues going on around the world. If in a perfect world, in a perfect environment for activists, we would all be able to be equally engaged and focused on particular issues at the same time. It wouldn't matter if you were, on one page working on gay marriage here in North America, meanwhile focusing a bit on climate change, you know, maybe after dinner, and then you were able to invest and focus on human rights violations on the other side of the planet. It would be great if that was the case. But for most people, it's not. We don't have the time or the resources. You know, being an activist and focusing on these issues, it takes a lot of time and energy. It takes a lot of your stamina to stay focused on this sort of thing. Burnout is a very real prospect, and if you overfocus your energy and try to, you know, fix the world, you are on course for a major burnout. And that has to be recognized. We can't go around expecting people to have this unlimited sense of activism. We have to be realistic here. Well, there's only so much, you know, so much ability that we have to engage on this. So again, to sort of recap, you know, if you're going to criticize an issue, if you're going to criticize the focus on an issue, you know, fine, whatever, do what you think is best. But make sure to frame that criticism in a way that doesn't throw the activists who are working hard under the bus. If you think that we have a misplaced priority in the charity sector, which is fine, and you're welcome to that viewpoint, but make sure that when you are criticizing that or bringing that to attention, that you focus on positive elements, that you are, instead of criticizing, you are saying, okay, well, let's maybe talk about areas where we could have a great impact. This way, you're not creating an adversarial or combative conversation. You're creating one that's more collaborative. And ultimately, that's going to be way more valuable than taking on a derisive tone and talking down to people who are, from their point of view, working just as hard as you are. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Class, shut up. Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we're back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, talking about the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. A reminder that if you want to take part in that conversation, you can by emailing us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at Ethan Clow or at Sector Podcast on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. Be sure to visit us at our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, to download our podcast and see our show notes. Now, at the top of the show, I mentioned that there had been a bit of an oil spill around Vancouver. The Port Metro Vancouver says that an oil spill occurred on English Bay Wednesday, and the Canadian Coast Guard is leading the cleanup operation as we speak. According to news reports, it happened around 5 p.m. Wednesday afternoon, and the source of the leak appears to be a ship, the Marathassa, and it looks like it was transporting... It looks like it was carrying grain across the Burrard Inlet. The oil spill in question has been reported by the city of Vancouver is toxic, so don't touch it. It has been washing up on shore and can be seen, well, from the Vancouver waterfront. And, you know, even if you do see it, don't pick it up, don't touch it. It could do damage. So cleanup crews are on the spill and are trying to contain it. You know, what's interesting about this is that the oil spill is actually the responsibility of the federal government. And city managers, city officials do not have a responsibility in this case. So they're actually working with the federal government to maintain this. One of the NDP MLAs said that this is a situation that reminds us there is a lot to be done before the province can allow oil tankers in the harbors. Quote, this shouldn't have happened. Obviously it has, but I think the federal government and the province have a responsibility. The fact that they didn't tell the city until 12 hours later is a huge failure. And that is a quote by NDP MLA Spender Chandra Herbert. Now, there's lots of pictures online that you can go and look at of the oil spill. And again, like, this obviously raises significant concerns about the idea of oil tankers moving past Vancouver, of pipelines moving through the Vancouver area. Clearly, the safety measures in place are not sufficient. And it's also quite clear that this indicates that, you know, the area is simply not suitable for oil transport of this nature. Hopefully this sends a message, but unlikely to. The only way to maintain that message, of course, is through the vote. So make sure you vote and remember this for next time. Now, speaking of the environment, I mentioned at the top of the show that a number of charities are pushing back against the Conservative government and these politically motivated charity audits. A public good letter was initiated by the Environmental Defense Executive Director, Tim Gray. It was asking all political parties to sign on to, quote, new legal and policy direction that enhances and protects the ability of registered charities to participate in public policy debates, without fear of government retaliation, of course. Several organizations have signed on to this letter, including Oxfam, Greenpeace, Amnesty International, and EcoJustice, among some of the 18 organizations that have signed on. To quote the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, Bruce Campbell, quote, I think this is a way to put all the parties on notice that it's time to make some changes. It's time to legitimize the importance of charitable organizations in the public policy debates. They are a force and a component of the public good, and this should be recognized. Now, this is something that we've touched on here in the sector many, many times in the past few weeks. The notion of restricting charities and nonprofits to the fringes of public debate is really self-defeating. These organizations play a major role in educating the public about these various issues. And if we sideline them and force them to the outskirts of the conversation, that is taking away a valuable resource for the public to get informed and to stay informed on the up-to-date developments relating to the environment or human rights or civil liberties or whatever it is that we're talking about. Now, I want to quote a few segments from the actual letter itself, and this is being sent to politicians across Canada. For one section in particular, I think is worth pointing out. Quote, first, the work of charities contributes greatly to Canada's democracy, and the health and vigor of our democracy depends on much more than citizens voting in elections. The extent to which elections are informed and motivated by citizens engaging with each other on issues they care about is an indicator of the overall health of our political system. These values are also connected to fundamental freedoms under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and basic rights under international human rights instruments that Canada has ratified. Increasingly, the international community is recognizing the importance of civil society's role in promoting and sustaining democratic and equitable societies, and the importance of enabling regulatory and legal environment that protects these groups' freedoms of association, peaceful assembly, and speech. So, obviously, very important, and I think that in a bit of a nutshell, kind of talks about the value that a charity can have on society. It's not just about, you know, fundraising and putting that money into your cause. It's also about interacting with the public and playing a key role in the development of new ideas and new policy. Here's another quote. "Most of all, however, charitable organizations serve a vital purpose in bringing the public interest to the forefront of public conversations. Without years of organizing effort by Canadian charities, Canada would not have dealt with issues such as addressing acid rain, promoting safe driving, reducing smoking, and banning toxic chemicals. These initiatives have all been led by the charitable sector." And again, this can't happen if the charity sector is kept at arm's length away from politics. What's interesting, of course, is that when the Conservative government began this crackdown, it was unusual in Canadian history. We've never actually had a system in place like this. We've never had the CRA be directed in this manner to focus on charities that engage in any potentially political activity. It's never been felt needed, and mainly because no government in Canadian history has ever found themselves on such a receiving end of ire from Canadian charities. And that is wholly the fault of that Conservative Party in Canada. You know, if you are going to be anti-science, if you are going to be anti-civil liberties, if you are going to be anti-human rights, then you have to expect these organizations to fight back and to make their voices heard. That is their responsibility. Their responsibility is not to the government of Canada, it is to the people who support them. And that's why this is so important. Charities need to be free to focus to their donors, to their membership base, to the people who direct them and push them on for their advocacy. They should not be responsible to government regulations designed to be put in place so that charities cannot bring attention to all the ways that government is screwing up the world. That's just common sense, of course. Let's take one last quick break here on the sector. We will return after this.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody.
God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Isn't there
anything? 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 Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we are back here on the sector, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Before we wrap up today's show, I wanted to talk a little bit about the question of privacy. Privacy in the sense that, as I've mentioned before, with growing government surveillance and these increasing security bills, both here in Canada and abroad, the question becomes one of how secure a nation can we make Canada while at the same time ensuring that our privacy is being respected and that we are not tolerating or indeed condoning a kind of draconian invasion, which violates the very fundamental realities of having civil liberties and having a free society. This came up in a recent episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, focusing on government surveillance. You've probably seen the video clips circulating around the internet, and I wanted to play just a little brief snippet of his interview with Edward Snowden. And perhaps, you know, we can use this as a springboard for future conversation, but I think it's actually really quite important, and it gives us a bit of a perspective on this notion of balancing security, which, and again, there are real concerns with security, but also balancing our civil liberties. Let's have a listen.
Why did you do this?
The NSA has the greatest surveillance capabilities that we've ever seen in history. Now, what they will argue is that they don't use this for nefarious purposes against American citizens. In some ways, that's true. But the real problem is that they're using these capabilities to make us vulnerable to them and then saying, while I have a gun pointed at your head, I'm not going to pull the trigger. Trust me.
So what's the NSA you want look like? Because you applied for a job at the NSA.
Right.
So you clearly see an inherent value in that shadowy organization.
I worked with mass surveillance systems against Chinese hackers. I saw that, you know, these things do have some purpose.
And you want your spies to be good at spying, to be fair.
Right. What you don't want is you don't want them spying inside their own country. Spies are great when they're on our side, but we can never forget that they're incredibly powerful and incredibly dangerous. And if they're off the leash, they can end up coming after us.
How many of those documents have you actually read?
I've evaluated all of the documents that are in the archive.
You've read every single one?
Well, I do understand what I turned over.
But there's a difference between understanding what's in the documents and reading what's in the documents.
I recognize the concern.
Right, because when you're handing over thousands of NSA documents, the last thing you want to do is read them.
I think it's fair to be concerned about, did this person do enough? Were they careful enough?
Especially when you're handling material like we know you're handling.
Well, in my defense, I'm not handling anything anymore. That's been passed to the journalists, and they're using extraordinary security measures to make sure that this is reported in the most responsible way.
But those are journalists with a lower technical skill set than you.
That's true, but they do understand, just like you and I do, just how important it is to get this right.
So the New York Times took a slide, didn't redact it properly, and in the end, it was possible for people to see that something was being used in Mosul on Al-Qaeda.
That is a problem.
Well, that's a f*** up.
It is a f*** up. And these things do happen in reporting. In journalism, we have to accept that some mistakes will be made. This is a fundamental concept of liberty.
Right, but you have to own that then. You're giving documents with information you know could be harmful, which could get out there.
Yes. If people act in bad faith.
You're not even talking about bad faith. You're talking about incompetence.
We are, but you will never be completely free from risk if you're free. The only time you can be free from risk is when you're in prison.
And we are back here with me, Ethan Clow, on The Sector. Now, I'm not going to play the whole interview, even though it is quite fascinating, and I do encourage you to check it out. I'll leave that for you to do, you know, on your own time. But again, you know, it raises certain questions that I think often go neglected in this debate. We obviously want security in our world. We want to make sure that we're protected, that we are safe, that we don't have to worry about terrorism, that we don't have to worry about, you know, all manner of unpleasant thoughts. And yet at the same time, we also want to maintain the fact that we can safely interact with each other without being monitored, without being tracked and logged and stored in some database somewhere. This conversation needs to happen, as John Oliver mentions on the show, that if we don't have this conversation now and make some real headway with this conversation, likely we will never be able to have it again. Because the longer that this surveillance and anti-privacy legislation and these bills, and as long as the status quo remains that we have this invasive security measures in place, the harder it will be to take them away down the road when we want to reevaluate how information is stored and viewed and protected. Ultimately, this conversation is not going to be over anytime soon. I suspect we'll be coming back to it again and again in the next coming weeks. As I mentioned before, I want to do a more in-depth analysis of the way that this conversation is happening in Canada. If anybody has any suggestions or thoughts on that, let me know. I'd be very interested to hear if you have any experts or people that you'd like me to try to contact, maybe who can speak to this in a greater detail than I can. If you have any of those suggestions, be sure to send them to sectorpodcast@gmail.com, or you can comment online on our blog at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. You can also get our podcast and our show notes there while you're at it. Anyway, as we sort of wrap things up for this week's show, it's been episode 41. As always, it's been a joy to produce, and I hope that you have enjoyed listening to it and are a bit more informed and a bit more engaged. Yes. Anyway, as always, the way to get a hold of us for any information, I've just given you our email and our website. You can tweet us at Ethan Clow, that's me, or at Sector Podcast on Twitter. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, you can listen live streaming each week at citr.ca. And if you donated during the fund drive, be sure to check out the progress of our new website and our eventual move into our new studio, which should be happening some point in the future. We're not quite sure when, but it'll be pretty soon. Anyway. Let us wrap things up. This is Ethan Clow, host of the Sector Podcast, saying thank you for tuning in. It was a pleasure as always. We will see you all next week here on the show. Same time, same channel. Stay tuned, because coming up next on CITR is Up on the Roof. I am sure they have a fantastic show planned for you. As for me, once again, thank you all and see you next week. So long and good luck.